where we differed slightly to Smith Brothers was the fact that we probably had got used to running positions in certainly certain markets. And I think that's something that was receptive to a degree at Ackroyd and Smithers.
Was there a particular skill in running positions that was different to what you'd call jobbing proper, turning over your book fairly rapidly?
Yeah, it's getting them right. this was the main skill, but just sitting there for that wee bit longer than perhaps one might have otherwise done, and perhaps selling that little extra bit of stock when you were short, and perhaps you buying that extra little bit of stock when you were a bull, and just waiting for what your gut told you was the right thing, and just waiting for the positions hopefully to come right.
What was the advantage of taking positions as opposed to turning over stock?
Not necessarily advantage. Sometimes called upon us by the customers, by the brokers, that they wanted a price in a large amount, and they weren't interested in doing part of the amount to leave you the balance to work on. They actually wanted the price, and you'd make the price and do a deal. Well, once you did that deal, you then had a largish position, and to trade that position for a tiny amount of money, the risk reward was totally wrong. So if you were going to take on that largest position and you thought that it was a reasonable position to have, you might sit with it for a bit and see if you could actually make an extra bit of cash out of it. But if it was a position that something was telling you was wrong, then you'd have to go out there and close it out, cut it. Even if you have to cut it, just go out and cut the thing if it's a wrong bargain. So I think if you thought the lines that you ran the good ones and cut the bad ones, you're probably in business.
Did you find you had adequate capital to take on some of these big positions?
What, at Ackroyd?
At Ackroyd, yes.
That was never a problem. Never a problem.
Did you feel in some ways that the guilt side
of
the
firm was able... Well, at Ackroyd, I think the company had just... was just going public, I think, was it 75, I think?
Yes.
They were just going public anyway. But I didn't think there were any... We never did a big deal because we couldn't find the money to do it.
I was going to ask, did you think, coming from a pure equity jobber, that Ackroyd's was in a position where they could sort of subsidise the equities from the gilts, and then vice versa, that they could shift resources around the firm?
I think that was the probably one of the thoughts with Ackroyd then of expanding the equity base, was that gilts were big market, big business, and the firm had fought its way into a good position, you know, in terms of size and profitability, that to expand the equity base was probably a good thing for a rainy day. Mm. And I think our firm, well, the boys from Bird and Goschalk joining Ackroyd fulfilled that role of expanding their business. Mm. We took a few markets to them, which they didn't trade oils. So there was quite a few papers, there's quite a few markets that we took to Ackroyd that they didn't actually deal in.
Just again, reverting to the larger size in which you were dealing and the position taking, did you find that particularly because there were fewer jobbers in your particular markets, that in fact you felt a kind of obligation to deal and a little bit of pressure on you in that respect?
Bit of pressure, bit of obligation, but at the same time, try and gauge the spread which you'd take that deal on, as, you know, for commercial reasons. But I think there was a certain feelings that one sort of shouldering on really to a certain degree. Mm.
Did you ever think that jobbing itself may have been ceasing to be a viable way of organising business in the stock market? In other words, did you feel that there was pressure on single capacity?
Well, I think there was pressure on single capacity. Well, it certainly came about when we were going to be investigated by the Office of Fair Trade. And I think one followed the other, that if stockbrokers that had fixed commissions, if those commissions were to become competitive, stockbrokers would need extra income. So any business that they had, they would want to cross or put through to boost their own incomes, and that would diminish the profitability of the jobber. And hence, I think, probably the basis for Big Man and dual capacity.
Did you find you were doing many put-throughs?
We were quite a few put-throughs going on, but the rules were such that at the time of dealing, we had the opportunity to say whether we wanted to do one side of the business, part of the business. And in fact, before a broker could actually put the stock through the jobber, when he had the one side of the deal, he had to approach the jobber to get those put through terms. It might be at that stage when they were discussing the put through terms that the jobber may desperately have wanted the stock and gave a good bid for it, and it had been sold to the jobber without the stock being put through. But nevertheless, if a put through was taking place, the jobber did have the opportunity to say, well, he'd like X number of shares to cover a bare position. But I think having the OFT position probably was the beginnings of dual capacity on the basis that both sides would lose income, and probably that.
It's said that during the 70s, a market in stocks and shares began to develop outside of the stock exchange. Did you feel, for example, that in the stocks in which you were trading, that institutions were dealing directly with each other?
We heard a lot, whether it was hearsay or fact, but one did hear that stock was changing hands between the institutions outside, and there probably was some foundation to it. But I can't really think it affected us greatly in the property share market. And I can't remember when it was actually set up, but I do believe we had a sister called Ariel that came on stream, which was a matching system between customers. But I don't think that really caught on.
By the same token, did you ever worry that some of the clients who perhaps would have been coming to the stock exchange otherwise were going to outside brokers or outside American banks to
I think we felt that American banks were probably getting involved, but without, I it probably was just, the market probably was just beginning to become a wee bit fragmented with, and I think Fleming Today, is it Fleming Today? They started a market making business outside the jobbing system on the stock exchange floor a few years prior to Big Bang. I think that was recorded in the press this morning. But it was the system was becoming fragmented.
Were brokers still using you as a form of a source of information on stocks?
Yeah, they'd still ask us what the... because we didn't have turnover figures in stocks as they are now. And brokers would ask us, is it much going on? Is there a reasonable market in the shares? And, the sort of everyday chit-chat, really. And what are the rumours? He'd ask him what the rumours are and what's going on in this stock. I mean, there was always that... that sort of chat was always there up until we came off the floor, really.
Mm-hmm. Were your contacts with people outside of the stock exchange any different to the earlier parts of your career? For example, did you have any contact with the outside investing public, either institutions?
Oh, we'd get to know that the some of the dealers, certainly the dealers with the clients, by being invited to brokers' lunches where they'd have a client there, or Christmas cocktail parties where the brokers would invite quite a few of their clients. They were mainly dealers from merchant banks and jobbers. So we got to chat. We used to have disagreements on what they thought we were and again how tough they were. But
could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I think it was the easy guy to blame at the end of the day was the jobber. And if a broker took an order and in simple terms messed it up, it was very easy to go back and say it was the jobber's fault, and the jobber was off. The job when I got back, jobber didn't want to price any longer, and so the jobber was the jobber. And but as time went by, and I guess we saw more of these people, clients, and the more they got to know us, then I think we slowly began to, you know, sort of help ourselves a wee bit. But we were always, it was always the simplest thing on earth to say it was the jobber's fault. Mm. And let the broker's dealer off the hook.
It's been said that some of the institutional investors wouldn't play fair, in the sense that they might break a large order into smaller chunks and send different brokers into the market with the same bit of a large order. Did that happen terribly much in your experience?
It happened, it did just take place, and I think we went through a bad patch, the jobbing system, from large orders being given to three or four different clients at the same time. And it was a matter of talking to the brokers themselves and just saying, look, you know, this has got to stop. And you've got to say to whoever this client is, you know, for goodness sake, stop it, because you're not doing us much good and you're probably not doing yourself much good at the end of the day. But under those circumstances, it really was a matter of standing up for yourself.
Mm. Roughly when did you go through this patch? Was it sort of mid-70s, late-70s?
Difficult to remember. Mm. May have been mid-70s, late-70s, but I can't really remember.
Mm. Any ideas about why that happened? I mean, did you have a lot of sort of new sort of fund managers coming in who didn't really know much about the etiquette?
It may again have been, as you say, new fund managers coming in and a different approach on how things should be done. But I think to a degree most jobbing firms did their best to stop it, sit on it. Although towards the latter part of trading on the floor before Big Bang, there were probably for 9 months it was a bit of a free-for-all. Mm. And I think a free-for-all on the basis that the brokers weren't quite sure after Big Bang where their income was coming from. So there was 9 months left, and to a certain degree quite a lot of the etiquette vanished. Mm. And even your chums were going round dealing with other market makers when the job I think part of the etiquette that did was vanishing pretty quickly was when we, as jobbers, were making prices to brokers, that we were making prices to leave an order, and those orders were still being taken elsewhere and executed. And that certainly was, and that was even being conducted by one's chums to the extent where they'd say to you, well, if I don't do it, somebody else will. So we did have a pretty difficult period on the floor.
Just to revert a little bit to the period shortly before, one thing that jobbers were criticised a lot for was spread agreements. It was something I believe brokers didn't like.
There were spread agreements in certain areas. Not in all, but in certain areas there were spread agreements. But there again, if a broker approached a jobber and wanted to execute an order inside that spread, I don't think that was a great deal of a problem. In the opening gambit may have been similar in width to the oppositions, but the actual price at which the deal took place could have been, I think most of the time, inside that quote, or if it was a large bargain outside the quotation.
Now, you mentioned earlier that the you joined Ackroyd in 1974. How did your career unfold with the company?
After I'd been here for, I think, two or three years, I was made a director of Ackroyd & Smithers. And, which I think I was one of seven directors that the company had. When Big Bang took place, I became a director of SG Warburg Securities, and at this present moment in time, I'm still a director of SG Warburg Securities and a joint chairman of the UK Equities Division.
Had you continued jobbing on the floor of the stock exchange right up to Big Bang?
Yes, I had. And we spent many evenings working with our partners on how we would conduct our business. After Big Bang, we wrote business plans, etc. But during the day, most of the time was spent still trading on the stock exchange floor.
Did you find jobbing itself had changed in any way from when you'd first started as a dealer in the early 1960s?
It changed. I think the biggest change of all was the greater risk taken towards the latter part before Big Bang than in the early days when we started, where I think I said earlier, we could actually leave that evening level in stocks, you know, at an even position, but certainly something that we couldn't achieve towards Big Bang.
Did you feel that jobbing was still a competitive business?
Oh yeah, it's still competitive. Everybody, to a degree, wants, I think it's in their makeup generally to be up the front there and be what's considered the market, to see the market. Certainly as a jobber, Minch, you saw more order flow than the opposition, and seeing more order flow to a degree helped you decide which way you thought that particular stock's next move was, because you were fortunate enough to see whether there was an imbalance of selling to buying, and obviously that would help you determine which where the show would move next. Mm.
Did you ever feel that there would have been more value if there had been more jobbers in the stock exchange? I suppose in one sense it wouldn't have been a value in the sense
was
it would have taken business
stage,
away from you.
Absolutely.
But what I meant was, do you think as a system of doing business it would have benefited a bit more? Markets may have been a bit more liquid or...
I think we've seen that from the jobbing system to now the market making system, where a great number of jobbers came down to a smaller number of jobbers but were bigger units that had the capital base to make prices in large amounts. And now we're coming to the new dealing system with market makers. We have a lot of market makers, but recently as one's seen that numbers are slowly coming down, but whether it there's sufficient business to go around to look after 20 market makers or integrated firms, or whether it should be a smaller number, I think that's mentioned in the Daily Telegraph this morning, isn't it? But certainly, I think on the jobbing system, when we were down to five jobbers, there was a reasonable amount of liquidity. And I think to have had 10 may not necessarily have been made the market any more liquid. In fact, it could have had the opposite effect.
And how would that have come about, the market becoming less liquid?
Again, what one's experience had been in the past jobbing is that you do need to see order flow, and if the order flow is spread among too many players, it can actually in some way have an effect on the liquidity given by each individual firm. That the more liquidity you do sit, the more orders you do see, trades that you do see, can encourage you into giving more liquidity to that stock or that sector or the whole sectors. But it really is one of order flow. Mm.
When you say give more liquidity, do you mean that you'd make closer prices, or you'd be a lot more prepared to take risks or to take positions?
I think probably more prepared to take risks and positions. Because price widths, it could affect price widths, and price widths could become narrow, but to actually get the best out of a quote-driven system, the marketplace needs to be one place and not fragmented, and it needs to see order flow.
What were your feelings when the stock exchange decided to do away with the jobbing system and do away with single capacity?
I think we were bracing ourselves for it, because it had been mooted by certain people, articles in the newspaper, so it never came as a great shock. What I think we all wanted to do was, and probably every member of the stock exchange wanted to be on the right side. And Aykroyd and Smithers knew whom we wanted to be with, and fortunately it worked out that way. And I think the thing that we all noticed, we felt we were going to notice, and we did, was probably a lot of the chums that relationships we've built up on the stock exchange floor with brokers, to all intents and purposes, was suddenly going to become the opposition. And once we came off floor, although you saw some of those guys occasionally, it never quite works out the same way of, well, we'll still see one another two or three times a week. It just never really, that's never really happened. So a lot of French, although we talk on telephones, but a lot of sort of face-to-face contact and chats and how's the family and this, those, what, that sort of thing seemed to vanish. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever think under the old system that jobber-broker relationships sometimes may have got a bit too close?
May have done. Although you could still have a pretty, still possibly have a good relationship, a friendly relationship with a broker, but 9:30 to 3:30 was something totally different. And because he had his job to do, and clients would, I thought, found out if the relationship between two guys was such that he was dealing at his disadvantage. I mean, that's purely on the business side of it, that if it was thought that in a relationship prices that guys were dealing at were wrong, but I mean, clients would soon find out if that was the case. But having a good relationship with brokers and vice versa acted in some ways the opposite way around, whereby if you did a lot of business with a broker, you were pretty well inclined to give him a good service on a continuing basis.
Do you think this is the way it worked for most of the jobbing firms, that they did have how does one put it, but relationships with particular brokers that were based on fairly long-established trading relationships?
Yeah, I thought so. Mm. I thought so.
But this didn't make it any less competitive, or would an outsider looking at it have said that it was a...
cozy relationship. Mm. Would be justified, I think, if... the relationship was such that prices that deals were taking place at were the wrong prices. Mm-hmm. But the big customers would soon have felt that they were, that was the quotation. What is the touch? Because the broker sometimes would go around the market checking prices with all three market makers and give the client the touch before he dealt. Other dealers might find the best way that they could deal is in their, they believed that they knew what the touch was, and it was safer just to go to one jobber to get a big order done and just do that trade. Nobody knew that trade had been done, but it had been done, whereby going around the market checking in all places, put sort of fire in three or four market or jobbers' tummies, and prices could start to move before he'd actually ever executed an order. So there was skill from a broker's dealer's point of view to, on some deals, know exactly where he was going and how he was going to execute that order and where he thought he was getting the best deal. And the professional broker's dealer was pretty good at that. Very good, in fact, of knowing who's pitch to appear on or deal over the telephone, but they got to know through experience. Mm-hmm. And if they've been given a bad deal by a jobber on more than one occasion, they tend to steer clear of him. Mm-hmm. But they'd go where they thought they could get accommodated extremely well. Mm-hmm. But that was part of the business, it was part of the jobber to give the broker that feeling of comfort that this was the place to be to do your business.
Had you stayed on the same pitch more or less throughout your
more or less
career?
From 61.
Did you feel that there'd either been any benefits in that, or do you think it would have been, were you ever tempted to get involved in other markets?
I think it if it's a pitch that you're on and you're getting what you want out of that pitch, you sort of satisfaction and profitability, then in some ways there's no reason why you should move. Guys do move around from pitches to pitches. It may be that they just don't like the particular market and they can't quite get on with it. Others, younger guys, might be yearning to have a go at that particular market. So But it varies for different reasons, but I thought if a guy is successful and making profits, there's not always a necessity to move them, because they do get to know, well, certainly under the jobbing system, the principal players, who is doing what, knowledge of how shares react under certain conditions, each individual share, that it did have a worth.
Were there brokers who specialised?
Brokers that specialise in property shares. Rowan Pittman did. Peter Hardy's here now. He was a specialist in property shares. A number of firms, I think one said earlier, Quilter, Goodison were specialists in property shares. Pamela Gordon, there are quite a few that did specialise in them.
Did they have any distinctive characteristics compared to stores or other sectors? In the way they behaved?
Not particularly. I mean, I think most guys in their sectors will always say, well, this sector is more difficult than your sector and vice versa. But you usually find that within sectors, to certain